Welcome into the Poetry Tavern, a place to discuss both reading and writing poetry, spotlighting new poems and ideas every week. Hello all, and welcome into the Poetry Tavern. My name's Charlotte, and I'm your host. And this week, we're talking about extended metaphors. Really, this is off the back of me doing a good couple of episodes on, like, wordplay and use of techniques within words. And I think looking at extended metaphors, like, the way that the message in the poem can be concealed through telling another story over the top is sort of similar to the allegory episode, which we did a couple of weeks ago. Anyway, that's extended metaphors for this week. I really like extended metaphors. I think they're easier to do in poetry than, like, maybe in a short story or a novel, probably because you have to keep it up for longer if you do an extended metaphor. I mean, you don't have to. I guess that's something I've put on myself, but I find them easier to do in poetry because of the allowances of the form. But I still think it's an interesting technique and it's an interesting sort of element to see. And I think it can sort of go unnoticed. I didn't pick poems where it goes unnoticed. It's very clear that these poems are extended metaphors by the time you reach the end of the poem. So yeah, save me just keep waffling about it. Why don't we just get into it? So our first poem is The Man Moth by Elizabeth Bishop. I found this poem and I'm a really big sort of, like, I would say the biggest, but, like, I always get a little bit of amusement out of urban legends. And then I was like, oh, so it's like Mothman when I first found this poem. And then to find out that it's because of a misprint of mammoth. Like, there was a newspaper where they misprinted the word mammoth as man moth. And it's so funny for Bishop to have taken this misprint and turned it into this, like, this fun poem that talks about something that I think is pretty cool. So let's just get into it. Let's start with the poem. Here above, cracks in the buildings are filled with battered moonlight. The whole shadow of man is only as big as his hat. It lies at his feet like a circle for a doll to stand on, and he makes an inverted pin, the point magnetized to the moon. He does not see the moon, he observes only her vast properties, feeling the queer light on his hands, neither warm nor cold, of a temperature impossible to record in thermometers. But when the man moth pays his rare, although occasional, visits to the surface, the moon looks rather different to him. He emerges from an opening under the edge of one of the sidewalks, and nervously begins to scale the faces of the buildings. He thinks the moon is a small hole at the top of the sky, proving the sky quite useless for protection. He trembles, but must investigate as high as he can climb. Up the facades, his shadow dragging like a photographer's cloth behind him, he climbs fearfully, thinking that this time he will manage to push his small head through the round, clean opening and be forced through as from a tube in black scrolls on the light. Man, standing below him, has no such illusions. But what the man moth fears most he must do, although he fails, of course, and falls back scared, but quite unhurt. Then he returns, to the pale subway of cement he calls his home. He flits, he flutters, and cannot get aboard the silent trains fast enough to suit him. The doors close swiftly. The man moth always seats himself facing the wrong way, and the train starts at once at its full, terrible speed, without a shift in gears or a gradation of any sort. He cannot tell the rate at which he travels backwards. Each night he must be carried through artificial tunnels and dream recurrent dreams, just as the tires recur beneath his train. These underlie his rushing brain. He does not dare look out the window, for the third rail, the unbroken draught of poison, runs there beside him. He regards it as a disease he has inherited the susceptibility to. He has to keep his hands in his pockets, as others must wear mufflers. If you catch him, hold up a flashlight to his eye. It's all dark pupil, an entire night itself whose haired horizon tightens as he stares back and closes up the eye. Then from the lids and one tear, his only possession, like the bee's sting, slips. Slyly he palms it, and if you're not paying attention, he'll swallow it. However, if you watch, he'll hand it over, cool as from underground springs and pure enough to drink. The very soul of this poem seems to sort of speak of a loneliness, like a isolation in going against the way that things are traditionally done. It's not clearly stated that the man-moth is ever in the wrong, but there are times where his behaviour is portrayed as strange, like what the man knows not to do, and he puts his hands in his pockets, and others where, you know, earmuffs, and he sits backwards on the train. And it all sort of creates this very lonely thing of there's no one telling him he's wrong, but he seems to come across as wrong, which may not be, like, accurate, but it almost feels like that loneliness that comes from being someone who doesn't quite conform to the unspoken rules of society. Like, there's nothing inherent in this poem that says he is wrong, but instead of being considered, like, part of man, he is man-moth. He is different. He is not one of them. I think that it's sad and it's lonely and it sort of feels like a love letter, like a recognition of people who do things different. And it's not necessarily saying that they're doing it incorrectly, but almost like they can be perceived as incorrect by just simply doing things the way that is best for them or the way that they wish to do things and for seeing the world differently. And then in the end to have the man-moth create something in his moments of like sensitivity and like hide it or destroy it when no one's looking and to readily hand it over. It almost feels like talking about like creatives. Like this might be a little bit of a stretch, but like to create something wonderful and then be so ready to give it away speaks to a lot of like, not give it away, share it with people. It speaks to a lot of like creative people I know's experiences, like they want to share their work with the world. So it's a really, there's a lot you can dig into here. And you know, if I had like 6 hours and this was an essay and not a podcast, I'd probably dig into it and I'd get deep in there. Okay, so our second poem is Divorce by Jose A. Alcantara. I genuinely, part of what I love about this poem is the only way it is decipherable what it's actually talking about is through the title. You know, other than the title, the word divorce is never used in the poem, and it's never like explicitly stated what it's talking about in the poem, but from the title gives us the key to unlock the information within the poem, and that's such an interesting way to go about it, to sort of not put in every clue into the body of the text, but rather to use the title as another device to help create meaning. It's so interesting. So I'm just gonna read the poem before I end up going into the rest of my talking points trying to introduce it. He has flown headfirst against the glass and now lies stunned on the stone patio, nothing moving but his quick beating heart. So you go to him, pick up his delicate body, and hold him in the cupped palms of your hands. You have always known he was beautiful, but it's only now, in his stillness, in his vulnerability, that you see the miracle of his being, how so much life fits in so small a space. And so you wait, keeping him warm against the unreasonable cold, trusting that when the time is right, when he has recovered both his strength and his sense of up and down, he will gather himself, flutter once or twice, and then rise, a streak of dazzling colour, against a slowly lifting sky. If you were to sort of listen to that poem, or read it yourself, or something along those lines for the first time, you sort of... I mean, I don't know about you as an audience. I think for me, I conjure in my mind the image of the bird crashing into the bird, as if there's only one bird on the planet, not, you know, dozens of species of bird. But the image of a bird crashing into a window because it cannot see the glass... I think that's never mentioned either. It's never explicitly said, oh, this is about a bird. But there is an image that's conjured in our mind because of the way that the creature is described. And I think we're almost supposed to replace this image of a bird with the image of a person, someone who intentionally or otherwise has self-destructive behaviour. I mean, it's so interesting for the poem to be called Divorce and for it to seem almost hopeful, like they're waiting for this person to get better, and maybe that's why it's called Divorce. Maybe they have come to the point where they cannot wait any longer for this person to, you know, pick themselves up, to fly away, and maybe this person, you know, keeps crashing into the window, whatever that actually is talking about. Maybe they pick themselves up, but it never lasts. There is so much hidden in what this poem is saying that we can only decipher in little pieces. It's like trying to figure out what's going on from like grainy footage. And it's even more obscure than that, I'd say, but it just... Yeah, there's so much hidden that makes it seem so obscured. I mean, obscured, it is obscured, like the true message, but I think you get just enough to realise what's going on. Yeah, it's just good fun. Okay, so that brings us to the end of our episode. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed. Let's start wrapping this up and talk about next episode, which next episode is going to be on lyric poetry. I think it's been a while since we've done a type of poetry. It's been a lot of ways that poems can tell stories or such, things of the like, things of, you know, techniques. I don't know if we've done a form since haikus, so... You know, we'll get into lyric poetry next episode. Hope you come back and hope you enjoyed. See ya.